I'm Shanna Merton, host of the Tech Tools for Teachers podcast, a part of the Education Podcast Network, just like the show you're listening to now. Shows on the network are individually owned and opinions expressed may not reflect others. Find other interesting education podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back. Steve here, and today I'm talking with Emmy Award winner Ben Tanzer about his latest novel, The Missing. What a powerful story. It will make you start thinking about your past, and if you have children, you're going to immediately want to know if they're okay. Great conversation. Awesome read. Couldn't put it down. Thanks for listening. Oh, by the way, it'd be so cool if you took a minute or two to help out the podcast. And there's a couple of different ways you could help me out. One of the ways is to tell a friend, you know, share the podcast with a friend, a family member, a colleague, you know, say, hey, you ought to listen to Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12. Another way would be, you know, go to my website and leave a review and subscribe. And how about this way? You could click on a link on my website homepage, which is, it's Buy Me a Coffee. Just click right there and it'll take you to where you could donate a dollar or two, you know, to help me address the costs associated with producing this podcast. That'd be so cool. Thanks for listening. Thanks for sharing. You are awesome. Enjoy the show.
Yeah, yes and no. So for the first time in my life, I have an agent. I'm only sharing that because I want to give her proper credit for saying something that really made a difference. She wanted me, before she was my agent, we were just having coffee. She wanted me to give her like a middle-aged guy novel. That was like the loose thing. I'm sure she was listening and she's saying, that is not what I said, but that's what I heard, right? I'd had a YA novel that hadn't gotten a lot of traction, but I thought there was a lot of interesting content. And I had this loose idea about, wouldn't it be cool to write about a marriage or a relationship over a long time?
It's the Education Podcast, your favorite show, with lots of groovy guests and they share what they know. So crank it up to 10 and let your neighbors know that here's another show with Dr. Steve Mileto. Teaching, learning, leading K-12. Teaching, learning, leading K-12, teaching, learning, leading K-12, with Dr. Steve Mileto.
Emmy Award winner Ben Tanzer's acclaimed work includes the short story collection Upstate, the science fiction novel Orphans, and the essay collections Lost in Space and Be Cool. Ben is a Story South and Pushcart nominee, a finalist for the annual National Indie Excellence and Eric Hoffer Book Awards, a winner of the Devil's Kitchen Literary Festival Nonfiction Prose Award, and a Midwest Book Award. He also received an honorable mention at the Chicago Writers Association Book Awards for traditional nonfiction and a bronze medal from the Independent Publisher Book Awards. He's written for Hemispheres, Punk Planet, Men's Health, and The Arrow, AARP's Gen X newsletter. His forthcoming novel, The Missing, will be released in spring 2024 by 713 Books. He lives in Chicago with his family, and our focus today will be his latest novel, The Missing. Ben, thanks so much for being on the show, and say hi to everyone.
Hi, everybody. Welcome. Thank you. I'm quite thrilled to be here. You and I have bantered back and forth for several years now, we realize. So I said it before we started recording. It's an honor to be part of your cadre of guests. And by the way, big congratulations, you're 600, well over 600 plus in. That's an impressive track record.
Well, thank you so much. Appreciate it, Ben. It's great to connect with you again and talk and get a chance to share with all the stuff going on our worlds. And so I probably should have been recording when we were talking before we started recording. So.
First, you'd have had to delete or edit half the things we said, though we didn't swear. That's good. That's good. But we did talk about it.
Yes, that's what's funny. Do you delete when you are talking about swearing versus, never mind.
right. That's a whole other thing. That's the episode we're going to do just about podcasting.
I like that. All right. So let's start with this, Ben. Have you always been a writer?
So no, maybe it's a both and kind of thing. I always loved books and I always loved writers. And at one point I really did start to fixate on feeling like I needed to become a writer, but I didn't actually write my first sentence till 30. So I am 20 plus years in, but that means I was 30 odd years of not writing before that. So I'm definitely not one of those guests where it's like, I wrote a novel at 8 years old and then I sat on it. You know, like I wish it would be fun to be one of those people, but I was more tortured and then I started. And now, however, I've probably written almost every day for 25 years, not yet today, but Yeah, no, now I'm a super compulsive everyday kind of person. So yeah, that's a sort of a long answer. The answer is no, but always obsessed with books and words and writers themselves.
Very cool. Very cool. And I know I've talked to some writers who they start talking about, well, when I was two, I started my first novel. And you're like, oh my gosh, man.
I'm so jealous of those people.
And I may be exaggerating about two, but you know, it is. Yeah. And I'm jealous too. It's like, wow. So good stuff. All right. So could you, let's talk about a little bit about writing for a minute before we get into the missing. Share a few thoughts with me. Do you outline or not?
I do not. I should clarify immediately by saying the one time I outlined a book, I wanted to experiment with it. I wrote that entire book so quickly for me that I thought, oh, there's really something to this. And then like other things in my life, I immediately abandoned that. What I do, however, which I suppose is akin to outlining, it's just much messier, is I'll spend however much amount of time I need to spend like writing notes about what I want to write. And then I'll slowly start seeing how they connect. It's usually very messy. It'll be like on a piece of paper, like a magazine cover. I'll jot down an idea. And then I might spend a year sort of creating almost a scattershot thing. Like, oh, make sure this is in there. Make sure that's in there. And then at some point I'll see, oh, that hangs together. And then when it feels like I've spent enough time doing that and I don't have a good algorithm for it, I'll just start and I'll look at all those notes and then I might organize those a little better. But yeah, I wish I outlined. I'm sure I'd be more efficient, but I can't. My brain is not organized like that. It's organized around ideas.
Nice. That's cool. I like hearing how different people think about it, because there's some who they got to have an outline. And then, like you said, I'd like to create the thoughts that are going to go into it. So good stuff. All right. So my next big writing question here has to do with, how do you get past a blank page?
So here I'm going to be one of your worst guests ever. that's not an issue for me as the way other people talk about it. I never feel like I'm staring at a blank page or a blank screen. I believe whatever else is going on, I really know every day when I wake up what I plan to do that day as far as writing. So I'm always in the middle of there's probably a sexier word than this, but I don't even know if we're allowed to use that word in that context anymore, but you know,
go for it.
I always know what project I'm on. I say calling your work projects maybe makes me sound more like my day job life, but I always know what I'm working on. And so I just pick up wherever I was the day before. If I'm in the middle of a book or a story, I sort of know where it's going. If I'm starting something new, I probably already handwritten a draft. If I don't have a draft, I already have the idea. One thing that helps me, this is a craft kind of comment, but it may not serve anyone. I don't worry at all about how the time will be used on a given day. It could be 500 words. It could be 6 words. Like, as long as I sit down and I'm engaged in the process. So I think that also takes the pressure off me. It doesn't matter how far I get. I only give myself about 30 minutes a day anyway. I'm fairly regimented about that because of work and children and the other things I want to spend time on. So, I always know what I'm going to do. So whenever I sit down, I just start. And that's probably got something to do with my brain anyway, but certainly it's not a thing. But I will say, if you were to say, Ben, how do you combat that? And again, I don't actually have to combat it. You plan it out, right? So whereas I don't outline a book, I outline every day in my head the day before, maybe even a week before. So I know what I'm going to be working on today whenever I have time to write. Like, it's waiting for me 6 inches away. And I know what tomorrow is going to be and so on. And I know I'm going to be on a plane on Thursday. So I'm thinking I'll probably end up writing on the plane. Should I be on a laptop or is it easier to write on paper? So I'm constantly plotting that out. And I think it's preemptive. I never run into a problem, which I think is very obnoxious. And I apologize to all your guests.
Nice, nice. Thanks. That's awesome, though. I love it because, you know, it lends itself, what you're talking about, lends itself to people who I've heard say there's no such thing as writer's block or something like that. And when you listen to them, they talk about something similar, which is that they know what they're going to write about. And they go about writing until it makes sense or something like that.
Well, and it's interesting. I'm going to say this a little ineloquently, but you know, I spend a lot of time with writers, as do you. I spend a lot of time with people who want to be writers, and hopefully they feel supported by me. But one thing I'll say to someone if they ask, and you're not asking this, but it's a subtext to your question, I am not remotely motivated by having to feel inspired, right? So I don't count on that. And again, if that's how other people operate, the goal is to get to the last sentence. So whatever your thing is, if I feel inspired, I may ditch what I was planning on doing and I may go in a different direction on the page, but I don't use inspiration at all. I treat it more like being an athlete, which is, and now it's time to write. You know what you're supposed to do today. There's a game plan and it helps a lot. You know, inspiration's cool. Some people say, I don't write for months at a time and then I'll write every day, 12 hours a day for 2 weeks and knock out a whole book. That sounds amazing to me and completely not appealing at all. So, you know, I just don't operate and I really can't operate like that, right? Like you, I go to work, I have young people I'm raising, you know, there's all these things going on. I'm not going to be able to set aside 3 days with the possibility I'm inspired. So maybe someday that sounds like something to aspire to. So little subtext to my obnoxious response.
I like that. I like that. All right. So let's get into your latest novel. I mean, and so now I'm going to ask you about what was your inspiration? So we're going to get to that word inspiration one way or another. I mean, so what was your inspiration for The Missing? I mean, why'd you write it? Is there a reason?
Yeah, yes and no. So for the first time in my life, I have an agent. I'm only sharing that because I want to give her proper credit for saying something that really made a difference. She wanted me, before she was my agent, we were just having coffee. She wanted me to give her like a middle-aged guy novel. That was like the loose thing. I'm sure she was listening and she's saying, that is not what I said, but that's what I heard, right? I'd had a YA novel that hadn't gotten a lot of traction, but I thought there was a lot of interesting content. And I had this loose idea about, wouldn't it be cool to write about a marriage or a relationship over a long time and the various things one might run into, which you and I talked about a bit during the pre-call. And so she said, well, what would that novel look like? And I was like, and I hadn't outlined it, but I had an idea in my head. And I said, it'll look like this. And they'll run into cancer, right? And things I know about. They'll run into this and that. I go, and at some point, maybe their kid will run away. And this is a true story. The agent paused and said, that's the book I want.
Wow.
Give me a book. Again, this is unwritten. Give me a book about a kid that runs away. And the way I'm going to use this word again, which I'm embarrassed by, the way my brain works, as soon as she said, give me that book, all of a sudden I could see the whole thing in my head, not all the detail. And I thought, okay, I'll go write that book. And so what I did was I thought, if you start with someone running away, where does it go? And then I thought, oh, good, I have all this material from this other book. That could be the backstory, some of the backstory for that teenager. But wait, it could also be some of the backstory for the mother. Let's look at the span, not just of someone running away, but the lives we all live, how we interacted with our own parents. Like, let's build a story about how things play forward and backward in our heads all the time. And then I was like off and running. And so there is the inspiration per se is really someone saying, do this. And I love being, it's funny. I love it when someone tells me what to do, you know, because I can take over from there. I used to have a boss. I had a pretty high level job. It was high level to me. And, you know, he wanted a guy who could make things happen. And I was when I was in the nonprofit field. And I would say to him, all I need is a sentence. Like I would write grants. I would write press releases, but I would also build workshops and, you know, but I didn't always know what he wanted and I didn't always know what was best. However, if he had a single idea, all he had to do was say a sentence and I could do anything with a sentence. I'd say, just give me a sentence. Like, where's your head at? And so similarly, when my agent said, do this, that's all I needed for 200 plus pages. I will add though, because this is important to the story and it's interesting what's happening recently. Years and years ago, I had heard a woman on, and I believe it's This American Life. It must be This American Life. Talking about how her kids, which to me is even more traumatizing, had run away and they had never come home and they didn't want to be in touch. And I could never shake how scary that sounded. So when she said, write about a running away, I thought, oh, it's not just running away. It's going to be a parent story and they are never going to know what happened. And no one's going to be in touch and the police aren't totally going to care, right? I had to hedge it in a good way. The kid had to be just old enough where the police are like, it's a teenager running away, like not underage, not criminal. That was important. So probably more than you wanted, but that's all that was running in my head. Then I thought, that seems so scary to me. What would that look like?
That's awesome. That was not more than I wanted. That was cool. Cause that really takes us in a path to understand how you're thinking when in creating this. And, Awesome. I love it. So one of the things that's awesome about your book is that you have a unique way in which the characters speak to the reader. So, and the story's built like this, because you're hearing different voices, and I don't mean that as a bad thing here. I mean that as, you've gone off into some other realm or something like this. You're hearing the voices of two of the main characters, right? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. As I was thinking about it, I thought, this is not going to be the kid's story. It's going to be the parent's story. The kid's going to be sort of a ghost, right? And I thought, well, I can I'm doing air quotes, not that your guests can see that, can write the father's perspective. But then I had my mother in my head and my wife in my head, who would probably say something like, why do we only get the father's perspective? That would have been them offering helpful criticism.
Nice,
so I thought, what would it look like if you told the story, the POV, from the perspective of the father and the mother? They're not going to experience this in the same way. They don't have the same life experiences. It doesn't matter how long you've been married. I've been married for 20 odd years, right? I still don't know everything in my wife's head. How could I? But as an author, you can try to figure some of that out. So immediately I thought, they need to be changing perspective, because they are not going to experience this in the same ways. And they don't have the same fears. They don't bear in their head the same responsibility. They have different issues with their own families. Like, then it seems so rich. And the only thing I'll add is, like, how could you write a parent story and not try to capture both? And for me, in my head, how would you not want to capture both perspectives? The other thing that's fun about it is just that they may not even be experiencing the same thing in real time in the same way. So the opening two chapters, which gives nothing away, is that you know immediately this kid's gone. And the opening scene is there's a police officer at their house. And so I thought, what would that look like? How's the husband going to experience this guy? And how's the wife going to experience this guy? So, I mean, that to me is so rich. And then the goal, right, is, I know we talked about cursing. Then the goal is not to F it up, right? Like, can you make them both seem believable? And then that became the real job to me, that they both are believable and have their own, you know, they have interconnected lives, but they also have very separate lives. And that I wanted to sort of understand and disentangle.
Boy, did you do a good, great job of that. And I
thank you.
I have to say, because, you know, you said you've been married 20 years. I've been married 37.
And 37. Amazing.
And there are lots of things that the way you wrote your characters and the way they talk to the reader is really kind of leans towards that idea, which you just said a second ago, which is that, you know, there's things you don't know. You know, even though you've been together for a long time, there's things that, even though you may know that about them, do you really, or do you experience things the same way, or do you see the world the same way? And I can tell you that ultimately, no, and there's any number of things. I just think you really hit the nail on the head there.
I'm really glad. It's funny. It's very, very, very minute, you know, as a parent too. And I think I put this in the book because I was conscious of it. You try to be on the same page, ideally, with your spouse around the parenting part, or at least the out loud part, right?
Right.
But it doesn't mean you always agree. So that's a subtext in the book also. They're trying to be a united front. Something I've run into with my mom, where she's like, I heard what you said. Did you believe that? Because she really knows me. And I'll say, because she'll say she's visiting, and I'll say, it doesn't matter if I believed it. Behind closed doors, I may have a different, we may have a different discussion, but in front of the children, yes, I believe that. And my wife would say the same thing. We don't always agree. And I think what's amazing, and I'm not proselytizing about marriage by any means, you know, I think if you're young, I don't know how I never thought about marriage at all, but you realize at some point, oh, we're not supposed to agree on everything. Like, that's okay. A sign of a healthy marriage isn't necessarily that you're always you're not always marching together, and that's cool. I mean, I would much rather be in a universe where you can live with someone and love them and you have separate lives and you don't always agree, and that you actually talk. So that's another piece of this, which I hope comes out. I'm fascinated by people's inability to communicate what they know is the right way to talk, or the right thing, or their feelings. And so they say the other thing, or they stop at the last second. You know, there's a scene where the wife really needs to tell the husband something, and it's early in the book, and then she pauses. She's just like, I don't want, it's not that she doesn't want him to know. she can't bear to say it out loud. And so that to me is a really interesting thing to get into, right? Even someone you love, you don't always tell them the truth. You don't always want to be vulnerable. And so that's one of the challenges of being in any kind of, not just in a relationship, like living in the world. How vulnerable do you want to be? And both of these people, I would say, are very uncomfortable with being fully vulnerable with anybody. And I find that fascinating, right? So they make decisions I wouldn't make. And so, wow, what would that look like?
Well, I tell you, especially when just stuff like what you just said, the idea that she doesn't say what she's thinking because of whatever. And, you know, a lot of times, the longer you're with somebody, you start thinking, you might be thinking about whether what their feelings are with something like this, or should I say this because is he going to overreact, or is there something like, I don't know. I use that one as an example because my wife says that I do have that tendency. So it's like, well, you know, come on, give me a chance. All right. But I think those differences in your characters play very well to anyone who's had a relationship that lasts for a long time, or because there's got to be a reason why it also lasts a while. And it doesn't necessarily come from ignoring things, but it does sometimes figuring out how to say something or when to say it, or, you know, what you're thinking about. And I think you've really gone into that. And I got to tell you, that's what it started off from started me thinking about going in those ranges. So, you know, something that your characters share are thoughts that I think parents have, especially when there is worry that something may have gone wrong in the world of their children or child. And, you know, something that would cause the parents to wonder if they could have been better parents, because your characters start really going into that world about what could we have done better. What do you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. What's interesting to me, right, is in the context of this universe, but then it's a larger thing, right? If your kid leaves and doesn't want to talk to you, arguably, there's probably better language for this, you've done something wrong, correct? I mean, even if the kid's happy and builds a happy life, something has gone wrong. Maybe you haven't done something wrong, but something has gone wrong. And so what I wanted to also play with was the parents trying to understand. And, you know, I believe most of us do something, but if you disagree, that's good for this interview. But, you know, a lot of times something goes wrong and you try to figure out your role in it. Ideally, see, another element of this is how self-aware are any of us? I like to write about characters who are self-aware, but still don't necessarily make the right decisions. That to me is fascinating. They know enough to know there's a better, more efficient, healthier way to do something. And then they're just like, F that, like, you know, for whatever reason, right? So that's an important element to this. So your kid runs away. And again, I'm speaking for my own fears, right? Like if one of my kids stopped talking to me, even if I thought they were totally wrong, and they may still stop talking to me, and they may listen to this interview and say, he's onto something. I actually don't want to be that guy's kid anymore. And then we'll have to deal with that, right? But even if they were correct, I would still have done something wrong, right? And so what I also love, though, a terrible word for this, is that you start picking apart the smallest thing. So there's a scene where he says, did she leave because of this thing that happened like 10, 15 years before that he didn't follow up on? Probably not, but maybe. See, you don't know. And that, I think, is an amazing thing about the human mind. We remember everything. We don't remember it moment to moment. But when you're in a crisis, all of a sudden you're like, was that the reason? Was that the reason? Is it a cumulative thing? And so that's what I really wanted to play with, right? So any of us who parent, though you don't have to parent. You could have a pet, right? You could have a niece or a nephew. You could be a teacher. You could have someone who reports to you at work. If something goes wrong, how do we try to understand why it went wrong? And then it may be at the end, you didn't do anything. I'm not a great parent, personally, me, Ben Tanzer, but I'm not a terrible parent. I'm probably somewhere in the middle, which to me is a small victory. My older son, hey, Miles, is listening, saying, no, you're terrible. You got that part right. And, you know, I have to, that's the other thing. If I am terrible, I also have to figure out a way to deal with that, right? And that's doing. Did we blow this? What does that mean about us? How am I going to cope? I love writing about coping. These people have terrible coping skills. And I'm really fascinated by that. But they also know better. They know their skills are terrible. And they keep doing the other thing. Not always, right? They make a lot of good decisions. And they almost take care of each other. But that's part of it, too. How much are we, how able are we to take care of the person in our life? We said we would when we got married or when we stuck around, but now we really have to. And I love the idea of that. I mean, it's a lot, right? You know, you made a comment earlier, how do people stay married? I mean, or in any relationship, doesn't have to be marriage. Again, I'm not pro-marriage or anti-marriage. Those my mom would say, and yet you've been married all this time. But what I think is fascinating is the reasons we stay in relationships are complicated, right? Maybe they're not always healthy. Maybe you're clinging on to the person. That's okay too, but do you understand that? Maybe you're just like, that person's your rock. You don't like them otherwise, but they're your rock. You know, like, I love the idea that we could talk about those things and try to write about them, and that people stay together for all kinds of reasons. And sorry, then I'll stop. People outside relationships almost never fully understand why you're with someone. They understand it to an extent, but again, they're not there behind closed doors. They're not there when you're sick. They're not there when you're in crisis. So no one really knows you. So that's the other thing with a book, right? You get to spend time with a couple where otherwise you wouldn't know them besides seeing them at a diner or at work or at a parent teacher conference. So that's fun to play with.
Well, I love definitely. And you do an awesome job with it. We had connected, and then there was a time where I had to make a short story. I had to have brain surgery, and you knew about that. And I had to go through that. And if I did not have my wife to help me when I got out of the hospital, because I went in thinking I was okay, you know, I knew what was wrong, but I go in and then when I come out, I had to have help doing all kinds of normal things. And it took me several months before I was able to go from one end of my driveway to the other without anybody's assistance. And, you know, then I graduated to being able to walk further. You know, it's like, and, you know, I think about the interactions that happen with families where it's like, you know, if the spouses, or in the relationship, whatever type of relationship it is, where you're, you might really become dependent on that person. And I just have to let you know, to tie it to your story, you just kind of bring all these thoughts out all of a sudden as they're thinking their different thoughts about what might have happened to the daughter, what might have gone wrong here, what, you know, what could we have done better, or, and then they are even thinking different ways that direction too. Because I wonder, as my wife was trying to figure out how to make things easier for me, I couldn't read, I couldn't look at a computer, I couldn't, without feeling, like my world was spinning and going around after all this was done. And it's like, you know, and I needed help to just do simple tasks for a while. And, you know, it's, got to tell you, glad she didn't say, oh, I'm done.
Yeah. Right. I mean, by the way, I'm so happy you're healthy. Like, we know each other just well enough. I knew things were going on, and hopefully I wasn't a pest checking in, but first off, just, I'm so glad you're healthy. Secondly, think about it. You had such an extreme thing. Without someone, you would have been flat. I mean, would it even be doable? But then as you were talking about it, and I was, fighting back any tears, I also thought, think about when something minor happens during the day, right? Like, you strain your neck, right, and all of a sudden you can't like pull your shirt on, and you say to the person, oh my gosh, could you lift that up for me? You know, or right, you can't bend over for half a day to take care of the dishes, and it's really your turn to do the dishes. And you're like, I'm not sure I can empty that. I mean, that's so minor and on the continuum of what you're describing, but still, these are the things that evolve in a relationship. Like, oh, I've got someone to do that. Right. Like, right, someone, you know, when my father died, one of the things he said to my mom, which always absolutely destroys me, and I'll probably have to use it in a book someday, it was kind of like, he didn't say it quite like this, but he's like, who's going to screw in the light bulbs now? Right. Like, you don't do those things. And I have at times visited my mom, and, you know, there's like a whole room where the light bulbs aren't. I mean, she would hate listening to this, but it's very meaningful to me. And it's not just because she's incapable, right? This is really important. It's just not her inclination.
Right.
She'll sit in the dark. I mean, that's one of the things I love about my mom too. It's like, I guess I'll sit in the dark, you know? But when you're in some kind of relationship, someone says, could I just take care of that? Or they just take care of it, right? Like, right, my dad was obsessive, like an obsessive sweeper, always sweeping like the breezeway. I grew up in upstate New York. The breezeway was always covered between the garage and the house, like in pine needles and leaves. And he was always trying to keep it clean. And every so often when the kitchen hasn't been swept in my apartment, my wife says, "You're the sweeper." Not because she's incapable of sweeping, but because that is sort of my gig, right? Nice. That's part of my dad's legacy. So I think it's really funny. I never agreed to be the sweeper. I just am.
That's awesome. I like that. That's a great, great analogy. That's a great thought right there. Because right now, I hope that a lot of listeners are thinking about, so what role is it that I've been taking on? Yeah, it's like, that's awesome. All right. So let's go back to the story. So the parents' daughter is Krista, and her parents have thoughts and memories from their high school days as they're dealing with the unknown about their daughter. And I thought this was pretty wild that you take them back to this, because then you do the reader too. I mean, because you cannot read this without starting to think about characters that you knew or how you were in high school as well, especially because one of the, I don't know if I should tell that part of the story in the beginning. I mean, they're going to meet somebody who they knew in high school and in a different, was a little different in high school, I guess, is what I should say. And, you know, they're dealing with the unknown about their daughter. I mean, why'd you go to those places? Why'd you have them suddenly start thinking about these past relationships and all that stuff that take them back into high school?
There's a basic element to me as a writer and a thinker, which is we're always trying to make sense of our past anyway, right? And on some level, sometimes it's conscious. You think, oh, am I doing this because of that, right? So you're trying to make connections. And the brain, and at least me personally, I'm always trying to make connections. Like, did this influence that? Like, and I should stress, my mother's a therapist. So to me, you know, all actions have the ability to be understood on a deeper level, right? You know, when someone says to me, that doesn't mean anything, I always think it means something. It might not mean anything important, but you didn't just do that. Maybe it's because your father said something to you 30 years ago. I mean, who knows, right? Like, who knows? So for example, I'm not the only person who does laundry in my house, but I am the chief laundry person. I am the chief laundry person because my parents really didn't do the laundry. They didn't take it seriously. And as a child, and I mean that literally, that became a very big deal to me very quickly. And so I said, can you buy a washer and a dryer? And they're like, well, yeah, they would do anything. And this is really important. My parents would have literally done anything you asked them to do. And they never questioned it. So I said, we need a washer. They used to send the laundry out. So then I'm doing my own laundry, like in elementary school. And then, well, you've got to fold it, right? Like, I can't go to school. So you start playing this out, right? So why am I sharing that? Because I still do the laundry obsessively. I fold it obsessively. And everybody in the house knows, don't bump into one of my piles and I'm doing all the laundry. I will lose it. So that's been built in, you know, 40 odd years of having a kind of obsessive, that's a singular part of my obsessive personality, which is clothes should be immediately folded in neat in piles. You know, I'm not like that about everything either, which would be problematic possibly. So I'm only sharing that because I know exactly why that happened. So if someone says, oh, you're the laundry guy, I can give you a whole narrative. I just did. So that's why in the book, I thought, let's try to, you don't always know how people's lives play out, but in a book, you can share that. So again, something happens with your daughter. Something happens with a daughter and an older boyfriend. You can flash back to being that age. What decisions did you make? How's that affecting you as an adult? How's that affecting you as a parent? These people got married fairly young. So Why did they do that? Well, let's go back to high school. Let's go back to childhood. One thing I can give away, because it's very early in the book, the mother, the female protagonist, one of the things she has to make sense of is her mother ran away. Her mother just left, was very kind in a way, like said goodbye, like, you know, and it wasn't a big explosion. She's just like, I gotta go, man. So it's not that casual, obviously. So now she's caught between, I have a mother that ran away, and now I have a daughter that ran away. What's wrong with me? And maybe nothing's wrong with her. I mean, that's also the problem, right? It may be nothing. So why would I go back? Because I want us to look at the whole narrative and how we make decisions along the way. And I think that's really, really interesting. You know, the character you mentioned, which, by the way, maybe I'm more self-conscious about it now that I'm talking about the book. Like, that character is an amalgamation of like a million people I know. I think that's important because there are slivers where someone could say, oh man, is Ben talking about me at 14? Maybe. But you know, I haven't even lived at home in 30 odd years. So I noticed the other day, I was thinking like, wow, some of this may float up, you know, but the point, to your point though, we have these relationships and we have these feelings. And as you said, we bring up thoughts. I want you also as a reader to think, what was I like at 17? Did that happen to me? Why didn't that happen to me? And so it seems to me you can't tell a present day story unless you try to understand the past. And then as an author, that's sort of fascinating. And then as a reader, I hope you're like, oh, I hadn't thought about that recently. That happened to me, or some version of that happened to me. So I wanted to do that, but then I just wanted to sort of go beyond the sort of, I'm obsessed with raw nerves, right? Not only am I not interested in telling a surface story, I want everything to feel very explosive on the page. So what's also interesting, and I always try to say this and make it sound smart, I probably don't. To me, all of our days, even if we're like very mellow, which I try to be, even if we have non-threatening jobs, like you're not a police officer, you're a former military, like the potential for things happening for someone like you versus me are dramatically different. I was a caseworker in New York City in the early 90s. There, every day, something almost happened. But I think my point is, things are happening all day long. And even though they may not be important to the larger universe, they may be explosive to you. And I wanted to sort of find those explosive things and see how they connect. That, I thought, makes for an interesting story.
Oh, and it does. And I think what you did was you made the characters so much more real, too. And they felt like, I might know these people. they might be my next door neighbors or something. And
good.
Kudos to you, because it made them, as they start delving into these thoughts and things like this, because it's like, you could see going back and trying to figure out where things went wrong or things they did in the past that, maybe I'm being punished because of something in the past now. And I mean, there's any number of strange thoughts that might enter you as you're dealing with, what may have happened in your current life with your child. And, on page 104, Gabriel's the father, says, I hadn't been a good person and I've poisoned Hannah, the mom, and by extension, our life together. This I'd come to accept. With words and scenes like this, you make the reader feel what your character might be feeling. I mean, let's talk about painting pictures with words. Can you do a little bit of that for me?
Sure. I mean, in this particular case, again, coming back to the thread you and I have hit a couple of times, he's looking at his life and you're being forced to, he's being forced to, I mean, in part because of this incident, he realizes he hasn't been, but he's always known and knows he's not as good a person as he wished he was. And in doing so, he has compromised his significant other's health and stability. And by stability, I don't mean mental stability. Also, I just mean the ability to go through the world with a kind of confidence. That's how he's poisoned her. He's made her life worse in a way because he didn't cope well with things, particularly in the past, right? See, that's the other thing. It's in the past. So they're in a better place, but that doesn't mean that past doesn't revisit. So painting a word with pictures, right? You're trying to pick words that are illustrative, right? You could say, I ruined her life, or you could say, I poisoned her life. So now you're dealing with like a metaphor or an image that says, oh, poisoned. That's a different thing. And you can feel that. If I say to you, Stephen, I hope I don't ruin your life, you'd be like, all right, Ben. If I say to you, I'm trying not to poison your life, then you're like, what's he talking about? What does he mean, poison my life? And also the idea of poison, I mean, we're just focusing on one word. And I don't even know if I was as depth as I'd like to be. Poison is a potentially a slow moving thing, right? It happens over time. And that's what also happens in relationships, good and bad. Things accumulate. So he has hopefully made his wife's life better in some ways, but the way he's made it worse has been very damaging. And that's what I want. So with any image I'm trying, and literally this is something I'll do when I go back and edit, I try to look at every word and think, is that the best word? Am I doing this the way I intended? Is every sentence hitting? Is there a way to describe this that isn't trite or leaning too casually on a metaphor, but is it actually, getting into the reader's brain like a worm? And you're like, ooh, he poisoned her life? I got to think about that. So I love that you pulled out that example. I'm sure I went back and looked at that word a number of times. There's also an element of this, if it's helpful, about being illustrative. So I had read an article a couple of years ago about gaslighting, which is now a very popular word. And there were people arguing that sort of gaslighting is a form, and I don't want to go too far down a road you wouldn't want to go down, but that gaslighting is a form of abuse. I had never thought about that. And so I thought, here's a guy, and again, this doesn't give anything away because we all gaslight our partners too, right? Even good partners shade the truth at times. And sometimes, as you pointed out earlier, to protect the person, like maybe I won't say this, I don't want to upset them. But I thought, this is interesting. When he's lied to her, or why he's lied to her, was it good for her or not good for her? I mean, that's also up to the reader to decide, right? But I thought, I believe most of us lie at times, and a lot of times, and this is the other thing, we think we're doing it with a good intention, right? Not always, but sometimes like, this is good for the other person. But maybe a year or so from now, the person will be like, why didn't you just tell me the truth back then? Like, you protected me, but not in a way I needed to be protected. So that gets back to your earlier comment about staying in relationships for many years and what we need from the person. You know, if you had a brain, you know, you mentioned your brain tumor. I'm not even remotely making light of that. There might be times your wife might have thought, I'm not going to tell Stephen how he's doing today. I'm just going to tell him he's doing great, right? Like, you need to hear that. I need to hear that. I need my wife at times to say, and my mom, good job, even though you know you're not doing a good job. Because if someone doesn't tell you, then you don't have the potential to overcome it, right? So this right. is what I'm trying to play with that scene. Now you're like, whoa, dude, that's way more than the word poisonous. But I'm fascinated by that, right? How the people in our lives tell us things, even well-meaning, that don't necessarily help us.
Oh, I think it's great. And I appreciate you sharing that. Because poison really fits, because we, you know, as adults, you know, you do things, and at some point you either forgive and forget, or you move on, or it just resonates below the surface. It just builds like the poison mite, like you're talking about. And then one day it all comes out and just overflows or does whatever, or, you know, silently takes the person away. And, you know, and it's, you built a lot of pictures there, and throughout the book, you have choice of words that really, make the reader, I kid you not, identify, or at least maybe not the same type of things they're going through, but it's making you think about things that you might have thought about in other situations or whatever. And, I think it's pretty amazing how you've hit those nerves. I think that's cool. So, you know, without giving away the ending, I think that your story would hit home with all parents. You know, on a TV show I once watched that had a family, the good and the bad of the family, one of the parent characters said something that I'll always remember, and it went something like this. He said, to be a parent means to worry always. And in the TV show, he was trying to comfort the other parent about something that was going on. Let's talk about your story resonating with parents. I mean, tell me where you might go with that.
So I have two thoughts on that, one of which I referenced slightly earlier, one of which is in reference to something you said earlier. The first is just, I'm shocked, there's got to be a better word, but we're talking about, you know, we've talked about self-awareness, that I didn't realize how worried I'd be all the time once I became a parent. And, you know, I want to use the right word again. I find that at times paralyzing, right? And then I have to do something to get out of my own headspace. So that to me was the most shocking element of being a parent. I mean, I had a younger brother. I did some kind of caretaking, but I didn't change diapers. I mean, you know, I didn't know anything about the basics of being a parent. I had never changed a diaper before my older son was born. Now, on the one hand, you say, dude, but you know, I was never around little kids. I had no interest in little kids. No one ever asked me to do it. So I didn't understand any of the basics, swaddling, you know, all of that stuff. So, but what I really didn't understand, and I found a lot of that to be enjoyable. So when other people complain, on the other hand, that was fun. I loved getting up in the middle of the night. You got this little baby, they need to be fed, they need to be held. You know, you drop them off at school, but I didn't understand how anxious I would be. And I'm just going to tell you and your audience, I hate it. I still hate it. It's terrible. Okay. And then it's balanced, right, by the intense feelings. And, you know, with my children, and I say this unabashedly, I never understood the range of emotions a human could possess until I had children. And you're speaking to someone who was in therapy for years, but it's incredible, you know? And so why am I saying that? Because one, I never understood it. So of course I'm trying to get that on the page. But two, and I think this is interesting in reference to something earlier, my parents, who are wonderful, were incredibly hands-off. We didn't have rules. my mom's not going to like this when she listens. I mean, in some ways, we were barely supervised. We were loved, right? Like, we were loved and we were listened to, but we were not supervised. So why am I sharing that? Because my mom, I think reflectively, might say, you did your thing. We trusted you. You were always capable. That's something she would definitely say. You, Ben, always seemed capable. We never worried about you. However, and so that's a narrative I have in my head, right? My parents didn't worry. Except years later, my mom said offhand, she's like, you know, and I made this reference earlier, but now I'm going to put it in some context. Once you got your license, I could never go to bed until I heard you come in the house. So she did worry, right? She always wanted to say she didn't, which I appreciate. And she was worried, which I also appreciate. And so that's what you're asking is what I'm trying to capture, which is the paradox of being a parent, which is I don't want to, and I have no choice. And you have no choice. You have no choice. I mean, sometimes my, you know, my older son, I mean, this seems ridiculous, but I know you get it. He doesn't drive. And we live in downtown Chicago. We don't even own a car. So if either of my kids want to start driving, we're going to have to buy a car. We haven't had a car in 30 years. But he was getting a ride back to school with a friend of his who I like, who's awesome. I'm sure she's a careful driver. I don't really know. And they left the house in a snowstorm. And in the back of my head, I thought, he needs to get back to school. They've delayed enough. But he better call me the second he's on his doorstep. Like, I'm going to spend the next 2+ hours in a panic. And I don't want to live like that. And I actually don't live like that, except in this context. So when you ask that question, right, that's it. He's 20-something years old. He's going to get to school safely. But you and I both know that's not a given, right? And since it's not a given, you have to be worried. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's how I feel about it. What's horrific and amazing and every adjective I can think of is, as a writer, it's gold, you know? I mean, I hate to be like, and look at that material, but I can draw on that in a second, right? It's right there. It's waiting. So I made this comment to you off when we weren't recording. This book is fiction in that almost nothing in it has ever happened to me. And most of those people, they don't even exist in any sort of shape, right? Like, I'm not trying to sound cool. Like, I created a whole universe. However, the fear, the anger, the confusion, the dissonance, the worry, dude, that's waiting. It's right there for me if I want to expose myself on the page. And I'm very comfortable with that. So what you're seeing is that worry, that fear, that anger, that joy. I know all about that.
Well, you make the reader live it also. And I kudos to you. The Missing is an amazing book. And if you are a parent, you're going to feel all these things that you've thought about, because it's just going to come flooding out. So I kudos to you there, Ben. It's awesome. We're about to finish up. And what I want to ask you first is, if someone wanted to follow up and connect with you and or learn more, where would you send them?
Well, as always, maybe not as always, that sounds like we're all hanging out together. My website, tanterben.com, and that's sort of the mothership. You can always come there. That's the always part. I try to make it user-friendly. It's easy to find me once you get there. But I also know you and I both use, to quite an extent, LinkedIn. And so if LinkedIn's your jam, come find me there. I have taken the approach over many years that I don't know where people are going to find me, so I try to be everywhere. If Twitter, I'm not going to call it X exactly, is still your thing, Facebook, Instagram, I'm tracking all that messaging, another obsession. So the website's a great place to start. LinkedIn, I'm thrilled to connect with people because I think it's a great tool for the things you and I do. But yeah, finding me is not that difficult. There are some other Ben Tansers who are active on social media, so you may need to wade through some of my competition, but that's cool. They seem really awesome. I just don't know them.
Nice, nice. Well, I'll put links to your LinkedIn and to your website and to some of the other places that you're located to in the show notes, so it's easy for the listeners to go find you. Good stuff. So I got two last questions I want to ask you, and one of them goes like this. How do you keep going when so much is going on that you may want to quit?
You know, this is like the blank page question, so I really appreciate it. And, you know, I don't have Yoda in the house, so that would be awesome. Or Mickey from Rocky. I think he says there ain't no quit. I think that's the phrase he uses in Rocky One. Like, I can't even relate to the idea of quitting. And I don't want that to sound, because I'm very conscious of being ableist, and I'm very conscious of being judgy. people stop doing things for all kinds of reasons, and I'm telling you, they've got my love and support. As far as writing, particularly, which I think is the heart of the question, how do you keep going? I think it's the opposite. How would I stop? You know, little cheesy apologies, but you know, I thought about it for a long time. I got started. Once I got started, there's never been a desire to stop. And annoying, I'm sure, there's so many things to write. You know, like there's so many books I still want to write. One of the things I've decided, I think you can appreciate this, though no pressure, you don't have to agree with me, is I've been using 70 as a benchmark. And at 70, I don't know why, it's arbitrary in a way. I want to pause and think, okay, you've now been writing for 35 years almost every day. You have been running almost every day for 50 plus years. Do you want to keep doing those things? Or, you know, health permitting, should we just try some new stuff? But even then, I already know the answer. No, I will not be stopping. So that doesn't help you. I don't even think about it. I mean, this is true. I just don't even think about it. And it's not because I'm blocking it out. I just wake up every day thinking, okay, today we write, today we run, today we journal, today we parent, today we get sure we're doing the work people ask us to do. You know, it's not tiring to me. Now, I have a benefit, and I think this is, I'm going to use this word one more time today, obnoxious. You know, I am not that young anymore. I mostly get to do things that I'm excited about, you know, and get the bills paid, which, again, now I'm being my father. But, you know, if you can get the bills paid, you're allowed to do the rest of it. Now, somewhere my mother is saying, allowed, you do whatever the hell you want. Yes. But, you know, I mostly do things I enjoy. And so really it's the physical limitations, right? And limitations of time that get in the way. And that's real. That's real for me. And that's helpful. I have all kinds of challenges, physical challenges, health challenges. And that doesn't mean I can't write and run and parent and sign checks when I owe people money. So good. I'm really blessed. And I want to stress that I'm not religious. I don't want to give anyone the wrong impression, but I have realized in my mid-50s now that, you know, I've been really blessed. So that's a gift. And I'm very appreciative.
That's awesome. Appreciate it. The last question. All right. So you've been writing. Do you have a favorite author or writing genre? I mean, if so, what is it or who is it?
I love you serving up a question like that to finish. So unquestionably, my favorite book and author is The Basketball Diaries by Jim Carroll. It's nonfiction. It's his translated journals that he translated. It came out late 60s, early 70s. That book blew my mind. I mean, blew my mind. And I honestly believe it has influenced everything art since then for me, including how I try to write, the raw nerves, being alive, the right words, all of it. It's influenced. I mean, I read everything. And because of, like you, I do a podcast. I have a lot of books come my way. They're not necessarily books I would have read. So I read every genre and I get a lot of pleasure out of it. But when push comes to shove, now there's the cliche phrase, give me a really hard hitting piece of nonfiction. And I don't mean a hard hitting like history, though I read history. I mean, tell me your story. I will engulf that. So yeah, I don't know if that's a genre. It's nonfiction. It's creative nonfiction. It can be funny. It can be angry. I definitely get the most pleasure out of very visceral stuff that is real or feels real, right? So there's a book, Cruddy, by Linda Barry. To me, it's a must read. Or Hairstyles the Dam by Joe Mino, who's a Chicago guy. Like, those books are fiction, but man, do they feel like they just wrote something straight out of their brain. That I'm very drawn to. That I love, and that I will read indefinitely. Past 70 even.
That's awesome. Love it, love it. Ben, thank you so much for sharing your novel, The Missing. What a powerful book. I love it. If you're a parent, The Missing will hit you hard in the heart, man. It really will. Wish you the best in all you do.
Well, thank you so much. And again, thank you for doing this. And thank you for doing what you do. I have sent authors your way that I work with, and they've been thrilled. So, you know, you're providing a service. I don't want to minimize it. I mean service in the best way. And so I can tell you as an author, fellow podcaster, book hustler, we really appreciate you. So thanks for having me as a guest, too. This was great. Great questions. And you know, your energy is awesome, man. I could feed off it. We could have done a 7-hour interview and I would have sat here sipping my iced coffee the whole time and thinking, man, Steven is kicking ass. So appreciate that too.
Hey, you have been listening to Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12, a podcast to help you help kids achieve their dreams.
Teaching Learning Leading K-12 is a member of the Education Podcast Network. Podcasts for educators, podcasts by educators. Teaching Learning Leading K-12 is a member of the podcast network based in Canada called Voice Ed Radio. Voice Ed Radio, your voice is right here. The opinions expressed on Teaching Learning Leading K-12 are those of the guests and host. Teaching Learning Leading K-12 is intended to share ideas, advice, and suggestions. Teaching Learning Leading K-12 is produced for educational purposes. Hey, thanks for listening. It would be awesome if you visited my website at stephenmoletto.com and connected with me, left a review, and listened to more episodes. And by the way, you could also share it with your friends, with your family, and your colleagues. Thanks so much. You're awesome.